All right.
Yep.
Let's go.
Hello, I'm Jessica Cadso-Collins, and this is the Inside the Jewel Vault podcast. Each episode, I ask my guests to choose the six gems or jewels they would put into their fantasy jewel vault. I hope you enjoy listening. This episode of Inside the Jewel Vault was recorded remotely.
I am delighted to welcome Wim Vertris to the Jewel Vault. Wim is Manager of Field Gemology at the Gemological Institute of America and Curator of the Institute's Coloured Stone Research Collection. Originally from Belgium, where he graduated as a geologist, Wim is now based in the global capital of gemstones, Bangkok, and he has first-hand knowledge of gem mining and has travelled, lectured and written extensively on coloured gems. He says he can find his way around the world's gemstone mining areas as well as the microscopic internal world of gemstones. Welcome, Wim. I can't wait to see what you've got for us inside the Jewel Vault.
Well, thanks for the introduction. That sounded great. I mean, you make me sound really competent here, and I hope I can live up to those expectations.
Absolutely. Well, Wim, you've got so much to tell us, but let's travel back to your childhood to find out where it all started for you. Can you explain, is there anyone in your family with this knowledge and passion for gems and travel?
Well, not really that I know of. Like my parents, my father works for the government, my mother's a teacher. I didn't have a rock collection as a kid. I didn't collect crystals or anything. But I do think there's a little bit of the travel and exploration genes in the family.
Right.
So my grandma's father, he was apparently quite the adventurous man. I never met him. But he, when he retired in the 60s, he decided to take a trip to Brazil by boat.
No.
So he just traveled to Brazil by boat. And the only real memory that I've seen of it is he had a suit made for that trip. And it was a white suit with a straw hat. And that, I mean, that has been passed down to generation. Like, I'm pretty tall, but, like, I think every other man in my family has worn it. And obviously not on trips to Brazil. Most of it was for parties because it's a white suit. It makes you look really badass. When I was young, my parents traveled a lot as well. And I was fortunate to really travel, not just go on holiday. Like I basically backpacked through India, Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia with my parents when I was like 12, 15 years old. For like 6 weeks where we roughed it in like hostels and everything. And really explored parts of Asia. So I think that came true as well. And I think it went that far that my mom always said, like, yeah, when you grow up and when you have a family, are you going to take them traveling too? And I think she was expecting me to go that far and not to say at a certain point 5 years ago, Mom, I've got a job. It's in Bangkok. I'm leaving in 6 weeks. I don't know when I'll be back.
Yeah, amazing. So you've got pioneers in your family, and now we can see where the adventurer in you comes from, Wim. So how did you come to discover the world of gems?
In the last semester of secondary school, during geography class, we had an introduction to geology by a teacher who was extremely passionate about it. And I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. Because there are so many sciences being combined together to really tell that whole story of how the Earth is working. And I was really intrigued with it. So I studied at the Catholic University of Leuven. So I did both my bachelor's and my master's degree over there. That's why, with a strong interest in science, I started engineering studies with the aim of then continuing into like mining and geotechnics. But it very quickly I realized like this is not for me. So after 1 year I switched to geology studies, and that basically was like the professor like, yeah, this is, we'll talk about this today, next week, 7 a.m. pack lunch, wear hiking boots, be at the bus at 7 o'clock because we're going to do some field work. And I was like, I found my tribe. These are my people.
Amazing. So that was it.
And that's just an incredible interaction where everyone was really united by that passion for earth sciences.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that was like oil exploration or dating of archaeological artifacts or like gold mineralizations or dinosaurs. It was a very small group, but extremely passionate about everything that they were doing, and that was really fun. So I really decided to focus more on like ore forming processes, metamorphic processes of rock.
Yeah.
Like I had the idea in my head, like metal exploration, that's what I want to do. Because I wanted to travel, I wanted to do field work. So basically looking for gold all around the world. That was the goal that I had in mind. Mm. But there was a super small elective class that that I spotted that was actually taught in Ghent. But it's only taught every 2 years. It's only 6 days or something, spread over 6 weeks. And it was taught by an external professor. And that was a class on gemstones. It was taught by a professor from HRD in Antwerp. So the Hoge Raad voor Diamant, the High Diamond Council in Antwerp.
I love it when it's pronounced properly. I couldn't ever begin to say it like that. But so this is the first piece in your vault, isn't it?
We were learning about diamond types. So type 1A, type 1B, type 2A, type 2B. And there's a slide on the board there that says that was discussing type 2 diamonds. So there's one of the other staff from HRD walks past the door and he pops his head inside and he sees, oh, you guys are learning about type 2B diamonds. Wait a second. He goes out, he comes back after 2 minutes, and he starts handing out type 2B flawless diamond crystals.
Yeah.
But I mean, like centimeter-sized chunks, like not like half carat, like rough diamonds with the most incredible rough etching patterns and trigons on them.
Yeah.
And he was like, oh yeah, we just had these come through the lab, and I thought you guys might be, like it might be educational for you to look at these. So I'm just sitting there on a Friday afternoon while at university, and Thursday night is party night usually, so I mean it wasn't super clear, but like I'm sitting in this room on a Friday afternoon and somebody just says, hold up, comes back a minute later and pops this, like, I don't know, 25 karat rough piece of type 2A, like perfectly colorless diamond with the most incredible figures, and I'm just sitting there with this piece in my hand like,
wow.
Well, I have no idea what this is worth, but I don't want to drop it. And this guy is just casually handing this out, but also sharing an incredible passion for this material.
Wow. So this is the first item in your vault, a rough diamond of the most perfect crystallization of carbon atoms there is, type 2. Very rare indeed, because 98-99% of diamonds are type 1 with gaps or vacancies in the atomic structure, the crystal lattice, where nitrogen is present, which is why they have a tint of colour, mainly yellowy-browny colours. But the finest and hardest, largest diamonds, in fact the great historic diamonds like the Koh-i-Noor, are type 2 diamonds with no nitrogen. So that's a really great first item in your vault. So, Vim, we have you, the early adventurer, now the evolving gemologist. How did you find your way into field gemology?
Yeah, so it's actually during those same classes, those same gemology classes that we took in Antwerp, there was one of the teachers there who asked us, like, you guys are all graduating next year. What are you going to do next year? It's like, I remember one girl who was also in the class. She's like, yeah, I'm going to continue studying on petroleum geology in Paris. One guy was like, I'm going to continue in geophysics. And then the teacher asked, like, is somebody interested in doing something with gemstones and a lot of field work? So I raised my hand and she's like, yeah, okay, I know this guy. He's looking for an assistant with a geology background. Reach out to him. So that was Vincent Pardieu, who was at the time the manager of the field gemology department in Bangkok.
Yeah, leading light.
So I basically reached out to him, and indeed he was looking for someone with a background in geology to join the department.
As an assistant.
So I decided basically in 1 week that I'm like, okay, I'm going to move to the other side of the world, and I have no idea what's going to happen, but I'm going to do it anyway.
Wow, that's a major undertaking. Gosh.
Yeah, so
commitment.
It was a bit of a difficult one, and then we said, like, okay, we're going to try this for 1 year, and we'll see if it works out. Yeah, it's been over 6 years now, so I think we can call that a raging success.
That's fantastic. And it obviously has. And what was it like then, to your first year or so working with Vincent?
Like, I joined him on a lot of expeditions in those first 2 years. So, yeah, we traveled a lot of places in Southeast Asia, in South Asia, but also East Africa, to learn the ropes there. But also most of the time is actually spent working in the lab, how it works, how it goes here. Because also, like, sure, I got this job at GIA, but I knew nothing about gemstones. I had those six days of classes at HRD in Antwerp under my belt, but that was very diamond focused. I mean,
okay, yeah, and of course, I mean, looking at the suffixes after your name, you've got GG, you've got FGA, so you've made up for it, haven't you? How did you manage to squeeze all of these in?
Yeah, exactly. So that first year was very intense, and then I was also doing my GG class, so the graduate gemologist from GIA in distance education. So doing that on my own time, but I raced through that. I think I completed the whole thing in 9 months or something. And then the same thing with the FGA. I did that fast track, and then I did the diploma the year after. So basically in 18 months, I got a massive crash course in, let's call it, formal gemological education. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I was picking up so much knowledge from just working in the lab, being surrounded with stones.
Yeah.
Also just being in Bangkok, meeting a lot of people here, being in the capital of colored stone trade.
So tell us, what is field gemology then? Because it sounds like you spend a lot of time in the lab, so it's not as outdoorsy as we'd imagine then.
Yeah, exactly. I think field gemology is a very loosely defined term. I don't think there's a strict definition for it. And for me, field gemology really covers basically everything related to gems before it is cut.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's where we can draw the line, more or less. So I think that includes gem formation, geology, mining, exploration. But I think also the rough trading. So, because it's not that a stone comes out of the ground and it ends up in a jewelry store. Like, there's a whole pipeline in between. And a lot of that pipeline is not really known.
Mm.
I think traditionally we've known very well what happens to stones once they are cut.
Yes.
Like the process of cutting stones, the process of jewelry making, that's all very well documented.
Mm.
But there's very few people that know how a stone goes from an artisanal mine in Africa to a trade center here in Bangkok, and how it is valued and handled along that way. How does it cross borders? How is it valued by the people in the bush, by the people in the local trade centers, by the people in the international trade centers?
Yeah.
Then, of course, the whole treatment aspect comes in there as well, which is incredibly important to get an understanding of what goes on there and why these people are treating, how they are treating, what the impact of that is.
Mm-hmm.
So I think for me, all of that is a bit of field gemology. So it's really that whole view of what happened to a gem before it is cut.
Yes.
There's a huge demand for that information, because 15 years ago, nobody cared what was going on at the mines or where their stone actually came from. But now everybody wants to know that information. So I'm super happy to share it. Like, what do the Burmese mines actually look like? Why does a Tanzanian garnet miner mine garnets over there and he doesn't do anything else? And what is it, under what conditions does he work? But yeah, that is only part of the job. Like, actually, most of the time I spend working in the lab. So field gemology sounds extremely romantic, but I think even on a good year, I spend about 75% of my time just working in the lab, where it's a bit more technical gemology. That goes from sample description, treatment experiments. There are a lot more questions that can be asked on top of the questions that are already answered.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, of course, that leads you into the realm of more geology and deposit formation.
Yeah. So tell us what the second item in your vault is. This is a very pretty little thing.
Yeah, it's really pretty. It's really tiny. And I think it really ties in with the GIA Colored Stone reference collection and the way that that works. So I think on paper, my biggest responsibility is taking care of the GIA reference collection. That means expanding it, maintaining it, but also making sure it gets used. Mm-hmm. So expanding it means adding material to it. And the one stone I chose now is a tiny emerald crystal from Ethiopia. Mm. So Ethiopian emeralds, they're fairly new to the market, but yeah, they're close to my heart because they're, in my short career, they have been a deposit that I've been able to track basically from the start to where it is now.
Mm-hmm.
I was among the first people to pick up rumors like there's emeralds in East Africa and they're not coming from Zambia. Something's going on.
Yeah.
But again, these are stones that we've seen in the trade. These are not really reliable. Like, we didn't even know they were from Ethiopia. We couldn't confirm they were from Ethiopia.
So this is why you have to travel.
Of course, you try to go to that place and really collect stones by yourself.
Yeah.
But that whole process took us like a year and a half to actually get into Ethiopia to visit the mines. So by the time we got to the mines, we had the permission. We were able to go. It was a pretty bad journey to go there because the seasons weren't right. It was raining. And basically the dirt road was converted into one slip and slide. So I think it was slipping and sliding for over 5 hours to cover less than 70 kilometers.
Oh my God.
Once we arrived, the mine wasn't actually working because it was a holiday or something, but we were able to go inside and collect our own samples. And all we found was this one little tiny emerald crystal.
Mm.
So it's a super tiny stone. I think it's like 0.2 carats, but it's a nice hexagonal emerald crystal. But it's extremely valuable in terms of research because with the analysis that we've been able to do on that little stone that I took out of the rock in Ethiopia myself, that completely matched all the previous observations that we made with material that was presumed to be Ethiopian. So that really confirmed all that. The unknown provenance of these older samples was all confirmed with that one little piece.
And this is what's so essential about actually visiting and collecting the material yourselves, because you can verify it.
Exactly. Like the reliability of your research samples is the most important of all.
Yeah. So you actually went to this open, it was an open pit, was it? And you
correct.
And
yeah,
you chipped this out using your own geological hammer.
Exactly.
Oh, I love it. So that's the second piece in your vault. So tell us what is in the third piece here. What's this third gem?
So the third piece is a piece that taught me some valuable lessons on trusting your own observations and trusting your own instincts.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a piece that was, we didn't really know what it was. It was given to a GIA field gemology team by a contact in Madagascar. And he said, I basically don't know what this is. I've got like a gut feeling, but I don't want to say it out loud. But I've got like 30 kilos of this, like a couple of buckets full.
Yeah.
Can you check what it is? So that was one of my first projects at GIA, like in my training, because it was an unknown piece. So it was good training, like to get used to some of the workflow, using simple gemological techniques, but also going more into advanced gemological techniques to really figure it out. Because we all had a feeling that was going to be something special. And like we were all quite surprised that sample was a perfect match for the mineral granditerite.
Mm.
So until that time, I think that was in like October or November 2015, granditerite was considered one of the rarest gems on Earth. Only a few faceted pieces were rumored to exist. Only one piece was really confirmed to exist. So basically one faceted stone, and I think it was like 0.17 carats, that faceted stone. That was the only one that was known.
Gosh, that's tiny.
And I had this chunk of unknown material, and it was a couple of grams. and it completely matched it. The months after, we saw a lot of Granditerite coming into the market. 6 years ago, it was extremely rare. That is not the case right now. And that just taught me a lot about, like, trust your own observations, but also be aware of how dynamic and how ever-changing this market is. Because something that was extremely rare yesterday could be very common today. Something that was not desired yesterday could be extremely desired tomorrow. So that just kept it really interesting, because although gemology can be considered as a rather conservative field in some regards, there's a lot of dynamics going on, and there's always things changing, especially in the colored stone world, where there's so much opening up right now.
So you were right at the front end of a new shift in gem material. I love that.
So, Vim, I imagine you have a bag packed with your field gemology kit and your boots and your hammer all ready by your front door. So where would be your next gem rush location? Which region do you think will be the next hotspot?
I mean, it's very hard to say. I mean, it's, I think a point I touched upon is it's so dynamic and so variable, and there's so many factors that come into play that it's extremely hard to predict. Like, if you would have asked me 5 months ago, then I would have said Afghanistan. But then all of a sudden, the Taliban took over, so I don't think anything really sustainable is going to happen there in terms of gem production in the next decade. But as always, East Africa is... we've only seen the beginning there. The variety of stones that is present there, and the resources that are still untapped, that is going to blow everyone's mind still. Because if you look at a place like Sri Lanka, where they've been mining sapphires for 2,000 years, they're still pulling stones out of the ground there. And East Africa, they've only been mining there for... there's a few places almost 100 years, but most places, 30, 40 years max. So there's going to be huge amounts of stones... also varieties that we don't typically associate with those countries, or countries that we don't even, that are not even on our radar as typical gem producers. Places like Malawi starting to produce incredible, or they have produced under the radar, but are not coming under the radar, incredible garnets. But like Congo is an extremely mineral rich country, but has never really produced any gemstones apart from the diamonds. But the potential for gemstones in Congo is starting to reveal itself with incredible green and pink tourmalines that have been mined over the last 3-4 years. But that is just showing up on the radar, like all these places, like Mozambican ruby, for example. For everyone who's familiar with the ruby trade, imagine a world without Mozambican ruby nowadays. That's the world we were living in 10 years ago, because 10 years ago, there was no Mozambican ruby discovered. And now half of the rubies in the trade centers are Mozambican rubies. So it's going to be extremely exciting for sure, but predicting what's happening where is almost impossible.
So that's the first three pieces in your vault. We've got a type 2 diamond in the rough, beautiful collector's piece that you were shown by a very passionate and enthusiastic HRD staffer, and you've got this tiny little piece of hand-hewn emerald from this southern Ethiopian mine, the first piece of material that you verified had come from southern Ethiopia, and then you've got this piece of Granditerite. And what is number four?
Well, yeah, number four is... it's also not the most impressive or the biggest piece, but it's again a piece that's very close to me, and that I will treasure. I will mainly treasure the memories around it. And it's a piece of jade. Mm. Jade is one of my favorite gems. It is probably the gem that I understand least of all, but that makes me love it even more. Because sometimes people divide gemstones in three big groups, where you've got diamonds, colored stones, and pearls. But I think jade is definitely in its own category as well. When I talk to jade connoisseurs, people that work with jade, I just see, every time I see glimpses of a world that makes it even more exotic and more foreign and more complex to me. And I'm so intrigued by everything to do with jade. And that's why one of my favorite places in the whole world is the jade market in Mandalay in Myanmar. So Burmese jade is regarded as the finest in the world. And in the city of Mandalay, there's a very lively market completely dedicated to the trade of jade. But they have a section of the market dedicated to the trade of rough jade. But that starts extremely early in the morning, around 3 a.m., when it's still pitch black. And it's an incredible atmosphere, because the only light in that market comes from the torches, so the flashlights that the buyers are using to inspect the quality of the jade. They do it at night because there's no interference from any daylight. So they have complete control over their light, and they can see how deep does my light penetrate, what's the glow throughout the material, where are the fractures. So everywhere you look, you see these strong beams of light, like almost like a lightsabers flashing around. Mm-hmm. But also this glow of green when people put the torch to the rough, and it emits this green glow. So it's,
yeah, I can imagine. It's,
but also,
it's a great description.
Yeah, all the other senses. And then there's a lot of smells. Of course, everyone who's been to Asia and who's been to markets in Asia knows that there's a lot of smells going on that you're not used to in the West. Markets in Belgium, mm-hmm. the town where I grew up, do not smell like the markets in Asia. So you've got this mix of smells and flavors, from the traditional Burmese fish soup that they eat for breakfast, the mohinga. You also have like the super strong smoke from the cheroots, like the hand-rolled cigars that are typical for Burma, that usually old ladies are smoking there. So you've got the mix of all these smells combined with like a little bit of that chilly atmosphere, with those, that soft green light coming from the stones, like illuminating the traders' faces, but also those super strong flashlights. But then the most special for me of that market is the sound of it.
Yeah.
Because there's piles of small jade pieces, like when people have, like when they trim the pieces, there's like these leftover bits, and they offer that for sale. So there's like piles of these little cutoffs. And when people move through it and those small jade pieces touch each other, it makes the most amazing pure sound. It is unbelievable.
Wow.
So I think that whole combination of like, when I think of that market, there is so much going on, and it's really a total experience. But especially that sound, because we're like, all these little pieces of jade touching each other, and that amazing, pure clinking sound.
Amazing.
And it's at that market that I met, actually, after sunrise. So when the rough trade is over, but they move more into the faceted stones, so cabochons, that I met a trader there who spoke some English. And he was very kind to explain to me how they were valued.
Wow.
Because for me, it was literally 50 shades of green. So I was like, there's so much going on here. There's such complexity. And then at the end, he actually took out one fine cabochon. I think it was about 8 millimeters long. And I remember, like, he took it out of his pocket from under the table. And the moment it just came into my eyesight, like, it wasn't even on the table yet, I realized, like, this is what people describe as imperial green. Like, that is the finest, freshest green, the purest green I have ever seen. It was electric, glowing from the inside. There's a tiny cabochon, under a centimeter long, maybe 2 millimeter high, but that was the finest quality jade that existed. Like, we were in a dark hall, and it just glowed, and it was incredible. So that's one of the pieces that really made me realize jade is such a special stone, and that is the stone I really want to keep.
Yeah. And this is why it's here in your vault. Oh, thank you so much for sharing that, because that is just so evocative. I mean, I was just there for a second, smelling all the smells of the cheroots and listening to the chink of the jade being handled. It's just glorious. Thank you so much. So that's 4 fabulous pieces now. What's piece number 5?
I think piece number 5 is I think it's actually two pieces, if that's all right.
okay.
it's actually a piece of jewelry. I think up till now they've all been gemstones, and objectively speaking, pretty insignificant gemstones, but with a very strong personal story attached to it, which is probably the most important thing for any piece of jewelry and gemstone.
Yeah.
But I've chosen a few pieces of jewelry because I have no clue about jewelry. But there's one guy that I met that made some pieces that really blew my mind just for the story and the thought process behind it. And I met this this jeweler, a guy called Derek Katzenbach, who had a bit of the same feeling. I mean, he's an excellent jeweler, an excellent metalsmith, an excellent stone setter. But he had that same feeling, like when you saw fine jewelry, high jewelry, it was designed to look at. It is not something to pick up. It is something to be appreciated from afar. And he wanted to create pieces that were begging to be picked up, begging to be inspected, begging to be, I think he literally said, made to be admired from all angles, but he literally said, made to be played with. So he brought all of his skills in designing lapidary work, metal work, jewelry techniques, stone setting. He brought that all together in an amazing piece that he was like reflection, gemstones. It's all very visual. What's the craziest visual experience I could probably make myself? And he built a kaleidoscope from scratch in gold and stones that he cut himself. So I think it's 18 karat yellow gold, over 70 carats of tourmalines that he cut himself, quartz lenses that he polished himself. Like, he made that whole design from scratch. It was eventually donated to GIA. It's now on display at the museum in Carlsbad for students to look at. But he also made another piece that I absolutely love. He wanted to make a piece of jewelry that nobody could resist picking up and start playing with it. So he made a spinning top set with all kinds of sapphires, garnets, alexandrites, tourmalines. So he took a very simple children's toy that he turned into the most spectacular whirl of colored gemstones and reflections. So I was, I've seen that piece during the Tucson show, I think 3 years ago. And I went to Derek every day to see, like, can I see it again? Like, make it spin again. And I've got a slow-mo video of it on my phone. And occasionally I just stare at it because it's incredible. Because when it spins, you see this entire rainbow of colored stones going through it. And it's, I mean, it's beautiful in gold and everything. And it's really, really awesome.
So I can see why you've chosen these two beautiful pieces to go into your vault. Now, you've got one final piece in here. Please tell us the story behind this and tell us what it is.
Yeah, so, I mean, this was a difficult one. But for me, this is also a stone that I learned a lot of lessons from. Because even though I've worked with gems now for the last 6 years, almost on a daily basis, I can still be amazed by the value that people attribute to gemstones. I mean, obviously, I can be amazed by a super fine stone, but then I hear what the prices of these stones, and I'm just, I have to sit down because my mind is sometimes just completely blown by it. When somebody tells me, like, yeah, this is $200,000 a carat, I'm like, that's a lot of money, but I honestly have no idea how much money. So I didn't really get, like, why would people put down that much money for a piece of rock? But I got it when I saw my first gem with a capital G, because there's a big difference there for me. And that was in Pailin, Cambodia. So it's right across the border with Thailand. The area is very known for its sapphires, but it also has ruby deposits. So the ruby deposits from Thailand stretch into Cambodia. So it's the same type of material. But GIA's Field Gemology Department has visited the area multiple times over the last decade, has built some very good relationships there. And one of those guys is a miner who's been mining there for rubies and sapphires for decades. So he's an older gentleman. He only speaks Khmer, so Cambodian, but he's extremely friendly and good-hearted man, always happy to see us. So he invited us to his house. He shared some mangosteen, like some tropical fruits from his garden. And his wife brought a tray of some rough stones that they recently mined that we can look at while we were enjoying some fruits and some water in his living room. And I mean, it was obviously fine material. It's always exciting to look at a tray of rough stones, especially ruby and sapphires. And it was fine material, but there's nothing really that would blow anyone's mind. But then he spoke to his wife, and his wife was... She was questioning what he was saying, and then he was replying back. But this was all in Cambodian. Like, we had no idea what was going on. We could just see that interaction. And then his wife closed the safe again, where she had taken the rough out. She went upstairs and came back with one single stone, and that was an incredible ruby. Intense red, 16 carats, almost clean. And she just put it in the middle of the table. But this is a massive table. Like, this is a huge piece of tropical wood, like the size of a conference table. She put it in the middle of the table and everything just went silent. It was like time stopped and everyone just stared at the stone. Because it's a 16 karat ruby of fine color.
Amazing.
Although Thai Cambodian rubies are classically not considered the finest rubies. But it is when I saw that stone that the miner was just sitting there with a grin on his face, because it was exactly the reaction he knew he was going to get. And I love to believe that he doesn't keep it in the safe. He actually keeps it under his pillow in his bedroom. That's why she had to go upstairs, because the safe is for the common gems, not for the gems with a capital G. But it is when I held that stone that I realized what a gemstone really was. Like, that was true beauty. A blend of the most fine crystallization you see in nature, a deep color, but also combined with the craftsmanship to turn that rough stone into a fine gem, the human endurance for mining for all that time to finally get that one single stone, because he'd been mining for more than 40 years and he only had one stone like that. The history of that whole area all combined in that single stone. And like I'm talking about it right now, I've literally got goosebumps again just thinking about that stone. So when I saw that stone, I was like, now I get it. Like, this is why people pay huge amounts of money for a stone. This is why people pursue gemstones and find jewelry all over the world for a passion. Because this is as beautiful as beauty gets.
I love it, Vim. This is just the most fantastic story. So out of these six amazing objects in your vault, I think I have an inkling of which one you'll choose. Are you going to tell us which one you would keep safe forever if you had them all to choose from?
No doubt the ruby, 100%. At that point, I understood why rubies are considered the king of gemstones.
Oh, Vim, thank you so much for sharing your six beautiful objects, well, seven beautiful objects in the vault, and for the stories that you've just shared. I think we could talk for hours, really.
Yeah, I mean, this has been a pleasure for me as well. I always get happy when I get the opportunity to talk about gemstones, and especially the gemstones that I really love. So yeah, this was really fun.
Well, thank you from the bottom of my heart. It's just been magic.
I hope you enjoyed listening to this episode as much as we did recording it. You can find images of all the wonderful jewels we've been talking about, along with lots more information, at our website. Just go to vipjewelvault.com/podcast. And I want to hear from you. Tell me, what special pieces would you put into your fantasy jewel vault and why? Every so often I'll be collating your stories into a podcast of their own, so please get in touch, and of course rate, review and subscribe, so we can keep these conversations as meaningful and joyous as we can. Thank you.